Section B. We do not endeavor to offer a comprehensive summary of the requisites for an adequate substitute for habeas corpus. We do consider it uncontroversial, however, that the privilege of habeas corpus entitles the prisoner to a meaningful opportunity to demonstrate that he is being held pursuant to the erroneous application or interpretation of relevant law. And the habeas court must have the power to order the conditional release of an individual unlawfully detained, though release need not be the exclusive remedy and is not the appropriate one in every case in which the writ is granted. These are the easily identified attributes of any constitutionally adequate habeas corpus proceeding, but depending on the circumstances, more may be required. Indeed, common law habeas corpus was, above all, an adaptable remedy. Its precise application and scope changed depending on the circumstances. Habeas is not a static, narrow, formalistic remedy. Its scope has grown to achieve its grand purpose. It appears the common law habeas court's role was most extensive in cases of pretrial and non-criminal detention, where there had been little or no previous judicial review of the cause for detention. Notably, the black letter rule that prisoners could not controvert facts in the jailer's return was not followed, or at least not with consistency, in such cases. The general rule was subject to exceptions, including cases of bail and impressment. When a prisoner applied for habeas corpus before indictment or trial, some courts examined the written depositions on which he had been arrested or committed, and others even heard oral testimony to determine whether the evidence was sufficient to justify holding him for trial. The early practice was not consistent. Courts occasionally permitted factual inquiries when no other opportunity for judicial review existed. There is evidence from 19th century American sources indicating that even in states that accorded strong res judicata effect to prior adjudications, habeas courts in this country routinely allowed prisoners to introduce exculpatory evidence that was either unknown or previously unavailable to the prisoner. Justice McLean, on circuit in 1855, expressed his view that a habeas court should consider a prior judgment conclusive where there was clearly jurisdiction and a full and fair hearing, but that it might not be so considered when any of these requisites were wanting. To illustrate the circumstances in which the prior adjudication did not bind the habeas court, he gave the example of a case in which several unimpeached witnesses provided new evidence to exculpate the prisoner. The idea that the necessary scope of habeas review in part depends upon the rigor of any earlier proceedings accords with our test for procedural adequacy in the due process context. This principle has an established foundation in habeas corpus jurisprudence as well, as Chief Justice Marshall's opinion in Ex parte Watkins, 1830, demonstrates. Like the petitioner in Swain, Watkins sought a writ of habeas corpus after being imprisoned pursuant to a judgment of the District of Columbia Court. In holding that the judgment stood on high ground, the Chief Justice emphasized the character of the court that rendered the original judgment, noting it was a court of record having general jurisdiction over criminal cases. In contrast to inferior tribunals of limited jurisdiction, courts of record had broad remedial powers, which gave the habeas court greater confidence in the judgment's validity. Accordingly, where relief is sought from a sentence that resulted from the judgment of a court of record, as was the case in Watkins and indeed in most federal habeas cases, considerable deference is owed to the court that ordered confinement. Likewise, in those cases, the prisoner should exhaust adequate alternative remedies before filing for the writ in federal court. Both aspects of federal habeas corpus review are justified because it can be assumed that in the usual course, a court of record provides defendants with a fair adversary proceeding. In cases involving state convictions, this framework also respects federalism, and in federal cases it has added justification because the prisoner already has had a chance to seek review of his conviction in a federal forum through a direct appeal. The present cases fall outside these categories, however, for here the detention is by executive order. Where a person is detained by executive order rather than, say, after being tried and convicted in a court, the need for collateral review is most pressing. A criminal conviction in the usual course occurs after a judicial hearing before a tribunal disinterested in the outcome and committed to procedures designed to ensure its own independence. These dynamics are not inherent in executive detention orders or executive review procedures. In this context, the need for habeas corpus is more urgent. The intended duration of the detention and the reasons for it bear upon the precise scope of the inquiry. Habeas corpus proceedings need not resemble a criminal trial, even when the detention is by executive order, but the writ must be effective. The habeas court must have sufficient authority to conduct a meaningful review of both the cause for detention and the executive's power to detain. To determine the necessary scope of habeas corpus review, therefore, we must assess the CSRT procedures, the mechanism through which petitioner's designation as enemy combatants became final. Whether one characterizes the CSRT procedures as a direct review of the executive's battlefield determination that the detainee is an enemy combatant, as the parties have and as we do, or as the first step in the collateral review of a battlefield determination, makes no difference in a proper analysis of whether the procedures Congress put in place are an adequate substitute for habeas corpus. What matters is the sum total of procedural protections afforded to the detainee at all stages, direct and collateral. Petitioners identify what they see as myriad deficiencies in the CSRTs. The most relevant for our purposes are the constraints upon the detainee's ability to rebut the factual basis for the government's assertion that he is an enemy combatant. As already noted, at the CSRT stage, the detainee has limited means to find or present evidence to challenge the government's case against him. He does not have the assistance of counsel and may not be aware of the most critical allegations that the government relied upon to order his detention. The detainee can confront witnesses that testify during the CSRT proceedings, but given that there are, no limits on the admission of hearsay evidence, the only requirement is that the tribunal deem the evidence relevant and helpful. The detainee's opportunity to question witnesses is likely to be more theoretical than real. The government defends the CSRT process, arguing that it was designed to conform to the procedures suggested by the plurality in Hamdi. Setting aside the fact that the relevant language in Hamdi did not garner a majority of the court, it does not control the matter at hand. None of the parties in Hamdi argued that there had been a suspension of the writ, nor could they. The Section 2241 habeas corpus process remained in place. Accordingly, the plurality concentrated on whether the executive had the authority to detain, and if so, what rights the detainee had under the due process clause. True, there are places in the Hamdi plurality opinion where it is difficult to tell where its extrapolation of Section 2241 ends and its analysis of the petitioner's due process rights begins. But the court had no occasion to define the necessary scope of habeas review for suspension clause purposes in the context of enemy combatant detentions. The closest the plurality came to doing so was in discussing whether, in light of separation of powers concerns, Section 2241 should be construed to forbid the district court from inquiring beyond the affidavit Hamdi's custodian provided in answer to the detainee's habeas petition. The plurality answered this question with an emphatic no, labeling this argument as extreme. Even if we were to assume that the CSRT satisfied due process standards, it would not end our inquiry. Habeas corpus is a collateral process that exists, in Justice Holmes's words, to cut through all forms and go to the very tissue of the structure. It comes in from the outside, not in subordination to the proceedings, and although every form may have been preserved, opens the inquiry whether they have been more than an empty shell. Even when the procedures authorizing detention are structurally sound, the suspension clause remains applicable and the writ relevant. This is so, as Heyman and Swain make clear, even where the prisoner is detained after a criminal trial conducted in full accordance with the protections of the Bill of Rights. Were this not the case, there would have been no reason for the court to inquire into the adequacy of substitute habeas procedures in Heyman and Swain. That the prisoners were detained pursuant to the most rigorous proceedings imaginable, a full criminal trial, would have been enough to render any habeas substitute acceptable per se. Although we make no judgment as to whether the CSRTs as currently constituted satisfy due process standards, we agree with petitioners that even when all the parties involved in this process act with diligence and in good faith, there is considerable risk of error in the tribunal's findings of fact. This is a risk inherent in any process that, in the words of the former chief judge of the Court of Appeals, is closed and accusatorial. And given that the consequence of error may be detention of persons for the duration of hostilities that may last a generation or more, this is a risk too significant to ignore. For the writ of habeas corpus, or its substitute, to function as an effective and proper remedy in this context, the court that conducts the habeas proceeding must have the means to correct errors that occurred during the CSRT proceedings. This includes some authority to assess the sufficiency of the government's evidence against the detainee. It also must have the authority to admit and consider relevant exculpatory evidence that was not introduced during the earlier proceeding. Federal habeas petitioners long have had the means to supplement the record on review, even in the post-conviction habeas setting. Here, that opportunity is constitutionally required. Consistent with the historic function and province of the writ, habeas corpus review may be more circumscribed if the underlying detention proceedings are more thorough than they were here. In two habeas cases involving enemy aliens tried for war crimes, In re Yamashita, 1946, and Ex parte Quirin, 1942, for example, this court limited its review to determining whether the executive had legal authority to try the petitioners by military commission. And the procedures used to try General Yamashita have been sharply criticized by members of this court. We need not revisit these cases, however. For, on their own terms, the proceedings in Yamashita and Quirin, like those in Eisenträger, had an adversarial structure that is lacking here. The extent of the showing required of the government in these cases is a matter to be determined. We need not explore it further at this stage. We do hold that when the judicial power to issue habeas corpus properly is invoked, the judicial officer must have adequate authority to make a determination in light of the relevant law and facts, and to formulate and issue appropriate orders for relief, including, if necessary, an order directing the petitioner's release.